The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
And welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for June 3rd, 2017. It's been another tough week for the cycling world, and nothing can prepare you for the sudden and unexpected loss of a colleague. On the heels of the loss of Adventure Cycling's Mike Demme and the rising star of the Action Hagens Berman team, Chad Young, this week the cycling world was thrown for a massive loop when press officer for that same team, Sean Whitey, was found dead in his home at the age of 49. My connection to Sean goes back to July of 2015 when he began feeding me great offers for conversations with the likes of Brent Bookwalter and Taylor Finney, Shelley Versus and Connie Carpenter Finney. He advised me on ideas for stories and helped me shape some of my interview questions. Sean and I were working on some new projects, and I will miss his spot-on insights and great ideas. Sean leaves behind five daughters. He called them his princesses, and a long list of admirers and friends and associates. I count myself among them. In an effort to give you a look into the life of this man who was always behind the scenes, working pretty much nonstop for the teams and riders and journalists, I contacted Velo News' Kaylee Fretz. Kaylee wrote a great article about Sean that is still unfolding as more and more stories come in from riders, team managers, Soignier, and other journalists. Kaylee's going to help to fill in the gaps of what will become one of the most difficult stories and losses we've experienced to date. We'll take a short break and then come back to speak with author Peter Cossens. He lives in France, not far from where stage 13 of this year's tour will be conducted, and his new book, The First Tour de France, 60 Cyclists and 19 Days of Daring on the Road to Paris, is just out. The book has a different title in the UK, which I found very interesting. It's titled Butcher, Blacksmith, Acrobat, Sweep. For some reason, the US publishers didn't like that title, so they renamed it The First Tour de France, which I think is very strange. What was wrong with the author's title? Anyway, most of us know that it was in 1903, newspapers were trying to increase circulation and sales and came up with the idea of a stage race for the first time. Peter spent a year diving into old archival records to ferret out the riders, the equipment, the news stories of the day, the good, the bad, and the ugly that really hasn't changed all that much in well over 100 years since. And while we might think that that first Tour de France was so different, he gives us some of the comparisons about how it is similar today, from cheating to equipment to sponsors. We'll take another short break after we talk with Peter and head on over to New York City to speak with Bike New York's events director, Jenna McLaughlin. We're circling back to some of the programs I spoke with Sean Pulser about in 2015, especially their educational classroom options. And then we're going to delve into what I think will be a great event on June 25th. There is a link here. The Discover Hudson Valley ride offers options from 15 to 100 miles of flat and rolling to hilly terrain beginning and ending in Poughkeepsie, New York in the Hudson Valley. The ride has music and food and beer and ice cream. And here's the link. All the proceeds go to the programs we discuss in the beginning of our conversation. Lastly, we're going to speak with one of the most interesting and iconic mountain bike racers ever. Hans Rey's about to jump out of the country and go to Europe for 7 weeks, and I wanted to catch up with him to talk about his new Tutti Frutti event. I think you'll find our conversation fun. So let's head on over to Colorado and speak with Kaylee Fretz about Sean Weedy. Hi, Kaylee. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks so much for talking to me today about Sean Weedy. How are you?
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm doing well. I've been better, but I'm doing well.
Yeah, I think the whole cycling world has done better. But I think you're going to have some perspective that I couldn't put on the situation with Sean and how important he was to all the riders and to the teams and to the whole journalists, you know, sort of pool of people who have worked with him over the years. Your article this week in Velo News had your thoughts and experiences of a lot of people whose lives he's touched. So tell us a little bit about your experience of Sean and how you worked with him.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a reporter, editor at Velo News, so I covered a lot of the teams and the riders, the athletes that Sean was working with. That was with Action and BMC. Most recently, I first met Sean when he was working with BMC Racing. And most of our interactions were, I mean, you consider them professional. They were, you know, I ran into him in Dubai every year. I would spend time with him at the Tour de France. I would see him every morning for a month as I stood outside the bus waiting for TJ Van Garderen to walk outside. And, you know, we would just chat, you know, chat about the day's racing, chat about what's going on, you know, occasionally get into more personal stuff. But really, it was just bike racing chatter. And Sean's job essentially is sort of this to be between folks like myself, you know, reporters, the press, and the athletes, because the athletes, they need their privacy. They really, if they said yes to everything that the press wanted, they would never actually get a chance to race the bikes. And so it was Sean's job to find that sort of happy medium, that balance between giving the press what they wanted and what they needed, what I wanted, what I needed to get my job done, and then also sort of almost protecting the riders from us, while also providing the team and its sponsors with media opportunities. So it's a very tricky, tricky job. And I ran into him at, you know, all over the world.
One of the things that I got out of your article that, and I know him strictly from, it's really interesting from either speaking with him on the phone or reaching out to each other about interviews that he's facilitating for me and projects that I'm working on. So I never actually got to be face to face with him. We had a completely different relationship from yours. And yet some of the things that you were saying, like, he just would appear from nowhere and everywhere to help. I saw the video of him, you know, hoofing a trainer on while he's riding a mountain bike to get it over to a rider so that he could get on the trainer and warm up before an event. He's just crazy. He was just not so crazy.
He was everywhere. He really was. So that video, after I heard of his passing, I reached out to a couple of riders who I knew. I had spent a lot of time with him, and that included Brent Bookwalter. I was just texting with Brent, and he knew of that video. He remembered that video, and we were able to dig it up. And I love that YouTube video. If you haven't seen it, if you go to the tribute story that we have on VeloNews.com right now, it's embedded in the middle of it. And it's basically Sean running around like a crazy person after the finish of a stage of the USA Pro Challenge, in which Brent Bookwalter is in the yellow jersey, and all of the things that he is juggling and all the things that he is doing, it was quintessential Sean Weedy to me. Those are the interactions that I had with him over and over and over again, except usually it was me stepping in the middle when he was trying to do a million other things and, you know, asking for something on top of it, because that's what we reporters are wont to do.
Yeah, being a pain in his ass, like he needed you, right?
Exactly, right? Exactly. You know, but the thing about Sean was that he did it all with a smile, and I had a brief chat with another one of his friends recently, who made the point that you actually didn't really know if Sean liked you. Like, he was so nice to everybody, and he was so kind to everybody, and he was so giving to everybody that he might have hated me. I have no idea. That might have been just an absolute thorn in his side. I never would have known. I would like to hope that I was not in his blacklist, but you would just never know, because that was the way that Sean operated. It didn't matter whether you were from the New York Times or Vela News, or you just had your own blog or whatever it was. It did not matter to him. He had the time of day for you, and he was always accommodating and just utterly, utterly professional. There's almost nobody doing that job today that I would put at the same level as Sean.
Yeah, talk about the loss. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Kaylee Fretz. We're talking about the passing of, I can't even hardly say his name today. It's just been horrible. Sean Whitey, he was the journalist's journalist in a way. He was the conduit between what I do, what Kaylee does, what the writers do, what the teams do, and then what listeners get to hear and what readers get to read. It's like he's invisible, and yet he's everywhere. At least he was. It was just amazing.
Yeah, and that was what I was trying to get across in the little tribute that I wrote, is that there were so many projects that we worked on that Sean really helped out a lot. You know, he was a big part of making a project happen. He probably put just as many hours into it as I did. And then, you know, the reporter and the writer gets to put their name on it, and no one ever knows what those press officers do. But really, without them, a lot of pro cycling would never end up on the computer screens and on the TV screens of cycling fans. It's an underrated position, an unknown position to a lot of cycling fans, I think.
And isn't this a terrible way to have to bring it to the fore, unfortunately?
Unfortunately, yeah.
So one of the projects that you and he worked on in, unfortunately, the not too recent past was the death of a young rider on the Axon Higgins Berman team, Chad Young. And you made a comment about that he thanked you for the piece that you did when you feel like you should have been thanking him. Tell us a little bit about that story, because it really does illustrate him once again. And it was his team.
Yeah, so this was Sean most recently was working as a press officer for Action. And actually, I added a story from Axel Burks, who runs that team, into the Vela News Post yesterday. Yeah, so what was it, 5-6 weeks ago now? Not that long ago now. Chad Young died in a horrible accident while racing. And so here at Vela News, we sat around trying to figure out the best way to handle news like that, and the best way to, you know, to pay tribute to a young man taken far, far too soon. And so, you know, we kind of decided to put together this package of tributes from people who knew him. And so the first place that I go in that instance is to his press officer, who is Sean. And I reached out to Sean and said, basically, you know, emails to send or phone calls to make. Sean, we're trying to pull together as many stories of Chad Young as we possibly can. I think that one of the best ways to pay tribute to a person is just to talk to the people around them and have them tell stories of the deceased, because I think that it paints the person in a brighter light, perhaps. And so, yeah, I reached out to Sean, and he immediately sprung into action, contacted the team photographer, who then passed on a big gallery full of images that we could use in the post. He sent out notes to the entire team, and actually started sending out notes to people outside the team to then send me their tributes, basically. And so he did as much, if not more, legwork on this project than I did. And again, it was like I said earlier, my name was at the top of the post, and he was thanking me for making this post. And yet he did, like I said, he did just as much, if not more, work in the back end of making a post like that happen. But that was just the way that he was. He was just always thanking the press for everything that we would do for him or for his team or for the guys that he was representing, the Action guys, the BMC guys. And he always downplayed his own role in that. You know, he's just a guy with no ego who was always propping everyone around him up, rather than taking the glory for himself. And that's really what I wanted to get across with this series of tributes, is that, you know, this guy was a lot more important than he would let on. He was a lot more important than he would ever admit. More important to the sport, more important to the people around him more important to the people in the sport than he would ever possibly admit. But really, at the end of the day, there are very few people within pro cycling who had a greater impact on pro cycling than Sean Whitey.
And very few people outside of the press corps knew of him. It's
exactly.
Just so amazing. Yeah. So I know this is one of those speculative questions that may or may not be something you've thought about. Now Action's lost their press officer. I know somebody else who's lost her project manager. You know, I've got a project that's sort of hanging in the wings. Who could possibly fill the shoes of a Sean Whitey?
Oh, I mean, yeah, there are lots of good press officers out there. I don't think that, there's no replacing Sean, particularly at a team like Action, which is a development team. You know, this is not a huge budget program. This is a very much a labor of love. And, you know, when he went from BMC to Action, it was most certainly taking on, certainly replacing some salary with love. There's no question about that. It would be impossible to replace him. There are plenty of great people still at Action. Action is going to need to hire a new press officer because it's a growing team and it's an important team. And having a press officer is a very important role for a team like that. But no, there's no direct replacement, no direct comparison to be made to Sean.
Well, it's interesting. People probably speculated as to why he would go from BMC to Action to stay in the United States. And of course, you said something in your post, and I know about it. And I think everybody who knows Sean, it was his daughters. He has five beautiful young daughters. I know he had a chance to go with another major team and chose to stay home with his girls. So, you know, you can kind of weigh the kind of person he is just by that. And so I'd like to ask last, how do you think the cycling world's going to remember Sean, and what can we do to sort of keep his memory alive?
Oh, well, I think that the number one thing, and there's a link to this in the story that we put up, there's currently a GoFundMe set up for his five girls who he called his princesses. It's going toward their education. And so we've linked to that on the story that we have currently on bellanews.com as a way to remember Sean. And for me, as a way to, you know, I wrote this actually in the comments when I gave some money to the GoFundMe. I can't count how many times I told Sean I owe you one. And so this is sort of the least that we could possibly do to try to balance that out a little bit. I think that is absolutely the best way that we could remember Sean is through his princesses, and the best way that we can that we can help the family kind of move forward as well.
Kaylee, thank you so much for writing the story. Again, it is in Velo News. The original publication date was June 1st, I think. It's already been updated June 2nd, and it's going to keep getting updated as more stories roll in about him. Sean Whitey, what an amazing man. Thanks, Kaylee.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Bye-bye. Kaylee Fretz joined me from his office in Colorado. The GoFundMe account for the Whitey Princess Scholarship Fund is GoFundMe.com/Whitey, W-E-I-D-E, princesses. If you are interested in helping the family, it's for the education of these five beautiful girls that were the light of Sean's life. We're going to take a real quick break. We'll be right back to speak with Peter Cossens about his new book, The First Tour de France. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back, and here we go, off to France to speak with Peter Cossens about his new book. Hello, Peter. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me all the way from the UK this morning. Oh, actually, you're in France.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Diane. Glad to be with you.
We're having a sort of a crazy Skype conversation, so we may be cutting in and out, and we may have to pause and go back once in a while. We're only a month away from the 2017 Tour de France, and evidently I have the American edition of your book, The First Tour de France. It just hit the bookstores, and it's really a lovely book. Obviously, you put a ton of history into this little tome. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of the book and the Tour de France, the first Tour de France.
Well, the book came about, I mean, the first tour is an interesting race because I think a lot of people, a lot of big cycling fans know a lot about it, or I think that they think they know a lot about it. When I was reading their story that I'd never picked up on before, I didn't know. And when I started digging around a bit, there were all kinds of little tales and anecdotes that were completely new to me. And I think the fascinating thing was that as I got more and more into it, the story of the 1903 tour is basically the story of every tour that's followed. I mean, you look back at that race, and although cycling has changed massively, obviously, I mean, they were racing on dirt roads, on extremely heavy bicycles. There was no tactic beyond you rode as fast and hard as you could. They didn't race in teams. But basically, the sport hasn't changed a massive amount since that point. I mean, thousands and thousands of people turned out to watch them, like just like they do on the tour now. It was a huge marketing and popular success, just like it is now. And there were all kinds of other things that you still see in race nowadays that basically started way back there in 1903.
It's interesting that you bring up some of the things like dirt roads, because here we are back to gravel racing in the U.S. You know, now we're sort of like moving back to the early days of racing. But some of these riders who showed up for the first Tour de France were not professionals. So what were they? Where did they come from?
Well, I mean, you mentioned you've got the U.S. edition of the book there. I mean, in the UK, the book's called Butcher, Blacksmith, Acrobat, Sweep. It's got a different title. And that's four of the professions that the riders have. The sweep in the title, the chimney sweep, is actually Maurice Garin, who was one of the few professionals in the race, but he'd been a chimney sweep when he was a young kid. And a lot of them were just drawn to the race, as sport did for a lot of people then and still does now in a lot of countries. A way out of poverty. It offered them riches. It offered them, one or two of them, fame, but it offered them an alternative to have this kind of hard, drudge-like existence that most of them would have had in those years.
When the promoters of the race, the first Tour de France, the 1903 race, decided to do this, it was a marketing ploy. It was to sell papers, right?
Yeah, that part of the story is quite well known. That Lotto, which was the forerunner of L'Équipe as it is nowadays, was one of the two or three sports papers that was on the market, or cycling papers. There was another, its big rival was called Le Vélo, the cycle. And they were in a circulation battle, basically, which Le Vélo was winning hands down. It was selling three times as many as Lotto. And both of these were trying to come up with ideas for events that would boost sales. Because they could see that if they put on big events, not necessarily only in cycling, but certainly cycling was very popular, whether it was track racing or whether it was one-day road races like Paris-Roubaix or something like that, they could see that they got a huge boost in circulation. What was very different about the Tour de France was when they came up with the idea, there'd never been a stage race anywhere before. So this was the first stage race ever, simply from that perspective. Evidently, when they started, nobody knew whether any of the riders were going to finish, whether the race would reach its conclusion.
How interesting. So they put it on hoping that it would end, as opposed to, well, here's your stage, here's the finish, here's your stage, here's your finish. And maybe people would show up and maybe people wouldn't, but people did show up. They didn't at the beginning, though, did they?
Yeah, they because they started in Paris, and I guess like in any big city, whether it be, I don't know, New York or London, wherever it might be, there are just a lot of major events on. And Paris at that time, start of the 20th century, was probably the greatest city in the world in terms of what was happening there. I mean, there was just so much going on there that the start of a a new cycling race really didn't capture anybody's attention whatsoever. So they set off. They were just like a few hundred at most people at the start.
Yeah, but it didn't end up that way. You know, certain of the riders, there were so many stories in this book about these riders, and you've got each stage, well, quite a few of the stages sort of laid out and how these riders came in. It looked like there were about 80 riders to start.
That's right. Yeah, there were 60, actually. I mean, there were about 90 or 100 it was supposed to start, and only 60 of them turned up.
I remember looking at the listing in the one chapter, and I remember the number was 80, but I forgot. Of course, 20 of them didn't even bother to show up.
Well, this is too much, or they had other stuff to do. I don't know. I mean, this is another interesting aspect of it, that getting information about it was extremely difficult because, I mean, the newspapers covered it, but they covered it in a completely different way to how races are covered now. So the writers gave very much their own perspective on what was happening every day. So, of course, they were writing for a newspaper that was trying to sell copies. So they weren't really interested a lot of the time in what the riders, the racers were doing. They were interested in what they're doing, but they weren't interested in what they thought. So you get very, very few quotes from the riders about what the conditions were like, how the racing went. So you just get this quite one-dimensional perspective, which is all about basically boosting the race all the time, saying how great it is. They completely played down all the difficulties they had in the race in terms of organisation and people cheating and all kinds of other things. They just made it sound like this great event. And people responded to that. The fans responded to that. Once they got into the provinces in France, people turned out in their tens of thousands. I mean, it was just completely overwhelming.
You already mentioned the C word, cheating. Tell us a little bit about the kind of cheating that went on in 1903. We already know it's very chemically induced here in today's modern racing. But what kind of cheating went on in 1903?
Well, a lot of the time it was quite... I suppose what we'd say is quite funny and quite basic things in terms of people getting on trains or people being towed by cars. I mean, there was a story of one guy riding along behind a car, and the judges noticed that there was a big piece of wire attached to the back of the car, and he had a wine cork with the wire was stuffed into the cork, and he was holding the cork between his teeth. And so the car was basically pulling him along on this kind of towing him. Riders dropped tacks on the course, so they dropped nails or whatever, and so that made their rivals puncture. Now, I mean, there were more obvious things as well. I mean, Garin, the lead guy, at one point actually takes a rival's bike and jumps up and down on it and rendered it completely useless for riding. So, I mean, they weren't subtle in what they were doing
at all.
Yeah, I
guess not. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Peter Cosens. He's written a book, the title of which is The First Tour de France here in the U.S. There were 60 cyclists, 19 days. So the race has changed over the years. We have 21 stages now, I think, and it always happens in July. Was this race in July, too?
It wasn't. It started on the 1st of July, yeah.
Okay.
And like you say, 19 days. But it was actually supposed to happen in May that year, but they had so few people signed up to race because the race was going to be a lot longer, and it was going to last for a month, basically. And racers just couldn't get time off from doing their other jobs because a lot of them had other professions. I mean, as I said, they worked as butchers or they worked as in circuses or wherever it might be. I mean, a lot of them were carpenters, for example. So they shortened the race, more people signed up for it. And, I mean, it was just by coincidence that it took place in July. And, of course, now it always does, and everybody expects it to.
Yeah, that's true. Some of these riders became very well-known and wealthy out of this race. But there was something going on with compensation for the riders. The organizers needed to make adjustments to that. Did they promise certain money up front?
Yeah, what happened was, I mean, obviously there was prize money for each stage, and people could, the first guys in won quite decent amounts of money. I mean, on some stages they were kind of, I think the first stage, for example, the first guy in, he won like the equivalent of 50 times the annual workers' wage on that one day. So there was a lot of money to be won, but the guys who were at the back, who were finishing hours and hours behind, they weren't earning anything. And so what the organizers did was they said, well, we're going to pay you a daily stipend. We're going to give you a few francs every day so that you can pay for your hotel, you can pay for food, you don't have to worry about expenses. And I mean, if they hadn't paid this, a lot of these guys would have ridden around France for nothing. They'd have been completely out of pocket because they weren't earning with their regular jobs either. But the proviso was that they had to finish in order to earn this money. And only 21 riders finished in Paris out of the 60 starters. So only 21 riders actually earned any, well, some of them dropped out, earned some money, but basically there were only about two dozen riders who actually earned anything out of the race at all. The rest just did it for nothing.
Wow. So they waste, well, who knows when they dropped out. They could have dropped out in week one or week two, whatever. That's interesting. So there are a lot of changes in the bicycle industry that happened out of this race. Suddenly we have manufacturers looking at products and new bikes. What kinds of things were going on with the bicycles themselves that, you know, maybe has carried forward? Obviously, sponsors became a big part of what the Tour de France is all about.
The bikes were basic. I mean, there's no getting around that. I mean, some of them didn't even have any brakes on them. So brakes were just sort of being used and being tested in various places. I mean, bear in mind that there were ups and downs on the race, but they were basically riding on flat roads most of the time. So one or two riders had brakes, but usually they just stick their feet out if they wanted to stop. Or as an alternative, one or two guys, they'd be carrying packs a lot of the time on their back or saddlebags, and they'd put a rock in their saddlebag to make them go slower down their descent, if just to kind of keep control of these bikes. And these bikes were not easy to keep a grip on. I mean, like I said, no brakes. They weighed around 30 pounds, probably most of them. They were just had one gear, so I mean, they were basic in their setup. You just, I mean, I suppose the simplest way to describe how they worked was that you basically, riders rode flat out from the start because they knew they were going to suffer mechanical, whether that was puncture or whether something was going to break on the bike. And if you were ahead of your rivals when that inevitable puncture or whatever it was happened, then you had some time in hand to kind of fix things and whatever. But the manufacturers are watching this and they're thinking, well, we can see all these people around the country turning out and there's just a huge market there. And so they began to see that by promoting the brands that these guys were riding, sales were picking up. And they started to look at things like improving tires and adding brakes to bikes, making them lighter, just making them easier to handle. And that, I mean, obviously that continues today and things are just reached a point where, I don't know, bikes can be 2 or 3 kilos if you want them to be. I mean, it's just that continued advance that started at that point and it's just gone on into the current day.
Yeah, being in the bike industry all my adult life, you know, I've watched the changes and note that the riders are the ones who usually test the new equipment. So if something's going to come out to the consumer, it's already been tested in a ride like the Tour, you know, one or two seasons ahead of time.
Yeah,
right. No, I want that. You know, the customer would come in, well, I want what he's riding. So what happened to these riders? You had Garon, you had Desgrange, for example. What happened to these guys?
One or two of them, like you said, they did actually go on and Garon had already had quite a long career. I think he was 32 when the Tour took place. So he'd already earned quite a bit of money for himself. And he came back as a defending champion the next year and rode the Tour again against, some of the guys who he'd beaten in 1903 appeared in 1904. Hippolyte Aucouturier, who was his big rival at that time, was again, he came back the next year as well. And Garat won the next year. But the first four riders, including Garat, were disqualified for cheating. I mean, it's never really been made clear what they did, because there were all kinds of things going on. I mean, the 1904 Tour was complete anarchy. Fans were running riot, literally running riot on the race. Shots were fired. Riders were beaten up. And they threw out the first four riders in the end. And that was the end of Garin's career. He never raced again at that. He retired back to the northeast of France. He ran a gas station in northeast France. And he did that for pretty much the next 50 years until he died. a lot of the other guys just disappeared back into obscurity. I mean, to the point where one or two of the guys who finished, I just couldn't find out any information on them at all. I mean, I went to the newspaper archives in Paris and we kind of spent hours going through trying to find details on these guys, and there was just nothing. They came out of nowhere and they disappeared back to nowhere. And I mean, to be honest, the guys who rode the 1903 tour, they were pioneers, and really most of them disappeared pretty quickly, because as the tour took off, within 5 or 6 years, you've got much more serious and seasoned and trained riders starting to come through. Already that kind of professional side of it became much more apparent. And these guys, for the most part, were amateurs.
Well, the book has so much history and researched history. How long did it take you from the time you said, I'm going to write this book, to the time it went to the publisher as a full galley ready to print?
I guess it was probably the best part of a year it took me.
Yeah, it's a lot of research. Well, the book is fascinating, and because the tour is coming up in a month, my listeners have a chance to read this and then compare today's race, which has no comparison to the 1903 race.
I think one of the things that's interesting about the book is, I mean, obviously I'm encouraging people to read it anyway, but to read it and see just how similar the race it was then to how it is nowadays, to see what an event it was, to see how the people turned out. I mean, like you say, all these things about cheating and technology, they were all happening then. They're not new things at all. They were all happening then, and they just continued. And I mean, all kinds of other aspects including the role of women within cycling, how that was very much frowned upon in 1903. And you could argue that to an extent it's being frowned upon in the modern era. Hopefully that's changing now. But I think that all stems from what was going on in France at that time, in terms of they didn't really want to see women riding bikes. They wanted to see them producing children and making the country strong in view of a perceived threat from next door neighbor Germany, which obviously resulted in a war maybe a decade or so later. So there are all kinds of issues going on there that you look back and you think, oh yeah, that's still happening now. We've still got that in cycling. We've still got this cheating. We still, whatever it might be. I mean, I just found it fascinating to see how much this race said about the modern day tour.
Well, it's a really well-researched, well-written, and fascinating book. Again, the title here in the U.S. is The First Tour de France. It's 60 cyclists and 19 days of daring on the road to Paris. Peter Cosens is the author and the researcher. It's an excellent book. I really appreciate you taking time from the Pyrenees today to talk with me. I wish I was there, but you'll get to see the race. Are you going to attend the race this year? Will you be there?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I've been to most of the tours for the last 20-odd years. So one of the stages that is on the race this year finishes just 6 kilometres from where I live. So this year, in fact, there's a sportif ride tomorrow covering the route of the stage. So I'll be getting in my own reconnaissance of the Tour de France Stage 13 tomorrow.
Wow, that'll be fun. That'll be fun. Well, one of the things we know that's changed a lot from the first one is the mountain stages. That's something that seems to be everybody's into the mountain, the Ventoux and the Lap d'Huez. But the truth is that your first race wasn't that mountainous. Do you know when the routes changed?
Yeah, they first came into the Pyrenees in 1910.
Hmm.
The first climb, they did climbs in smaller mountain ranges before that, but this was the first venture into the Pyrenees in 1910. And they actually climbed the Col de Port, which is, there's a mountain in between me and it, but it's literally about a dozen miles away from where I live, and a lovely little climb. And then they went on the next day and climbed the Tourmalet and the Aubisque, and the legend of the Tour de France in the mountains was born that day, really. So, I mean, that goes back more than a century now. But like you say, I mean, for me, the tour's mostly about the mountains. That's why I live in the Pyrenees. That's why I love the race.
I hope you enjoy it this year. And you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite for 2017?
I would have said, if you hadn't ridden the Giro, I would have said Quintana would be my favorite, because I think the route might have favoured him a bit. At the moment, I'd have to say Richie Porte. I mean, Chris Froome, obviously, you've got to think of, but Richie Porte's been the form rider of the year. So if he can hold everything together, if he can stay on his bike, if he doesn't have any bad luck, maybe it's his year.
That would be fun. I would like to see that. Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking with me today. Where can people get copies of your book? I guess at all the usual suspects, huh?
That's right, yeah. I mean, Barnes & Noble and on all the big bookstores over there.
Yeah, of which there are not so many. The big bookstore is not a store. It's online, but I imagine it's there too. We will post it on our website. We will post it on our Facebook page. Good luck with the sales of the book. It's very good. I think it's a great idea to read it before this year's tour and get some comparisons.
Many thanks, Diane. Good talking to you.
You have a great day.
And you. Thanks very much indeed.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye then. Bye.
Peter Cossens joined me from his home in France. We need to take another quick break, and we will be back to talk with Jenna McLaughlin about the Discover Hudson Valley ride coming up June 25th.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of the Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back, and here we go to New York City to speak with Bike New York's events director, Jenna McLaughlin. Hi, Jenna. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, back in 2015, we spoke with Sam Pulser from Bike New York about your organization, but I think it'd be a good idea to review some of your programs before we talk about what really interests me, which is a ride that's coming up that I wish I could do.
Definitely. So we have both classroom style and on-bike classes for both kids and adults. And they're all free and open to the public. And our classroom experience sort of gives people a chance to learn the rules of the road, how to best handle scenarios that they'll encounter as a city cyclist. So, for example, our street skills class covers fundamentals like where on the road to ride, how to safely change lanes, and how to utilize bike infrastructure. And then we also have more specialized classroom style classes like Bike Commuting 101, we have a Family Cycling 101, and then also a class on how to buy a bike.
Let me remind our listeners a moment. We're speaking with Jenna McLaughlin. She is the PR person for Bike New York?
I'm actually the director of events.
Oh, even better, because that's what we're going to talk about, right?
Yeah, perfect.
Let's talk about the Discover Hudson Valley ride. So tell us about this ride, when it is, you know, where it starts and ends, and what the distances are.
Sure. So the ride is coming up in a couple weeks. It's on Sunday, June 25th, and it starts and ends in beautiful Poughkeepsie, New York, of course. And we kind of have a distance for everybody out there. So we have five distances total, 15 miles, 33 miles, 55 miles, 75 miles, and then also 100 miles for those wanting a full century.
Wow. How do you monitor that many routes, or are people just starting out on the same route and then peeling off, or are they loops?
So they all start out on the same route for the first few miles, and then they kind of break off into various loops as they go along. So let's say that if you're riding the 100-mile route, you're really also riding all of the 55-mile and all of the 75-mile with an extra 25-mile loop in there. So we're able to kind of monitor the routes a little bit easier since they kind of all loop back on each other.
Yeah, that is the best way to usually do it as opposed to stringing people out 100 miles or 50 miles out somewhere and you don't know where they are.
Right.
Do you have a rider cap?
We don't have a rider cap on this one. Last year we had a great turnout with about 2,400 people registered.
Wow.
This year we're pushing 2,500 to 3,000. So we're really hoping to get more people out there to see the Hudson Valley. It's a beautiful route. The scenery is just amazing from rolling hills to farms and pastures. You know, you'll see out some farm cows and some horses out there. And then also, you know, the downtown of the Poughkeepsie area, and you can't beat finishing and ending right by the Hudson River.
You mentioned terrain, you mentioned rolling, but you didn't mention elevation. Now, your website is wonderful. It has lots and lots of information. Each route you give the amount of feet climbed. What is the, I think the 50, did the 55-mile route have 2,900 feet? Was that what I remember?
Yeah, so the 55-mile route has about 2,900-foot elevation gain along the way. And then our 100-mile route is upwards of like 5,900 feet of elevation gain. So it's definitely a hilly route. You know, the 15 and the 33 miles are much easier, and they don't travel up some of the larger hills as much. But for those longer distances, it's definitely one folks want to train for and be prepared for.
So how many stops are there? Let's start with the 100-mile and work backwards, because 100 miles is a long way to go and everybody needs food and it could be hot.
Yeah, last year we had a really hot year. It was about 95 degrees outside.
Oh.
But we have 6 rest areas along the way. Some of them are hit twice, so you may hit it on your way out and then again on your way back. So the 100-mile riders, I think, end up stopping at or have the option to stop at about 8 different rest areas. And all of the rest areas are fully stocked with snacks and drinks, music playing, and we have some great volunteers from the local community and staff on site to really just kind of get them jazzed up while they're resting before they head back out.
I think I remember seeing a barbecue lunch. Is that right?
Yes. Brand new this year, we're going to have a barbecue lunch, which is included in registration. So people will come back to the Finish Festival. They'll, you know, grab a burger, hot dog, grilled chicken. We also have some pulled pork that will be there. And it's all from a local restaurant up in the Poughkeepsie area. So we're excited to work with them. And on top of that, the riders will also get a complimentary beer from New Belgium and a free ice cream.
I'm trying to put beer and ice cream in the same sentence, but I'm having a hard time. I'm glad that's after the ride, right?
Yeah, yes, it's after. Yeah.
So I guess the most important thing, two important things. One is the proceeds of this ride go to Bike New York and to programs that you're doing. Tell us a little bit about the programs for which this ride is specifically slated.
Absolutely. So all of our events that we put on at Bike New York, the proceeds fully go to our free bike education program. So those bike classes I was talking about earlier, the classroom classes that we have, and then also some of our free programming. We also offer like after school programming, summer camps, and then we just launched our newest program, Gear Femmes, which aims to get more women and trans and femme cyclists riding on city streets. So all of the proceeds from this event and all of our other events throughout the year go to all of these programs and classes.
Where can people find out more information about it?
Yeah, they can head over to our website at bike.nyc. They can sign up for the Discover Hudson Valley ride right there, and then also check out some more information about our other events that we have and our other programming.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me about Bike New York and the Discover Hudson Valley ride. Jenna McLaughlin, who is the events director for Bike New York, thanks so much. Have a great ride. Hope you have great weather, and thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. You have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
New York, thanks so much. Have a great ride. Hope you have great weather, and thanks. Jenna McLaughlin joined me from the offices of Bike New York. We're going to take another real quick break for a station ID, and we'll be back to hear my interview with Hans Ray. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Hi, Hans. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
My pleasure, Diane.
So you're getting ready to leave the country and head over to Italy. Tell us what's going on.
Well, I'm spending every summer a lot of time in Europe, different events and different sponsors and things I do in my work, and I'm leaving for a 7-week trip and go all over the place a little bit, England and Italy and Switzerland and Germany and Austria and so on.
Wow, it sounds like fun.
It is. It always is cool, and you know, with my European roots, it's fun to be back home and see the people and the places there, and it's so cool there in the summertime, you know, when everybody starts biking and stuff. So yeah, I actually, first thing I'm going to do is I signed up I let myself talk into a big road bike ride, and that's not exactly my forte if you like riding road bikes across the Alps. But Gary, the founder of Glyphbar, is doing this big ride across the Stelvio and Gavia, and for some reason, I committed to the ride, so now I'm going to do this huge road bike ride, and then after that, I'm going to visit a few festivals and have all kinds of meetings, spend some time with my wife in England in between, so, and of course, go back to Livigno and ride all the cool trails there.
So let me ask you a question about your road bike. What will you be riding for this epic Stelvio-type ride?
Well, I'm going to ride the GT Crate, which is a gravel bike, so it's basically just a really fun road bike. It's very functional. It has flared handlebars, which I love the feel of those bars. And it has 28 tires. And I put a compact gearing on, so it's I have a little bit more, it's a little bit easier on me on those really big passes, because we have a few days where we have to climb 10,000 feet. So that's kind of more than I've ever ridden on a road bike. So we'll see how that goes.
So a sensible bike. It's like having sensible shoes for hiking, right?
Exactly. Fun and functional.
Fun and functional. I think more and more people are heading for those wider tires and a little more upright position and compact gearing. It just makes sense for the kind of riding we're all doing. We're not like Peloton riders here, many of us, most of us.
Oh, totally. Like you say, with the gearing too. I mean, the days are over. Like when Greg LeMond, they used to push those hard gears up over the mountains. You know, now even the pros run a lot of lower gears than they used to 20 years ago. So you know, we all get smarter, I guess.
Let's hope so, that's what happens. So tell us a little bit about is it Carosello 3000 mountain bike facility? It's about to open in June in Italy. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, they open every summer, and it's in Livigno, Italy. That's an Italian resort town that I actually have spent a lot of time in the last 10 years. And they have two big mountain resorts in that town, and one of them is the Carosello 3000. And while the other resort has a hardcore bike park, these guys build more like a trail center with, like, kind of trails, flowy trails geared towards, like, basically all mountain and trail riders and enduro kind of stuff, cross country, and even family and beginner friendly. You know, like, so often you go to places and these bike parks are built by the hardcore for the hardcore, and more people have adopted flow country trails and flow trails that everybody can ride. And the people so often think that when there's an easy flow trail, it's boring for the good riders. But if a trail is built right, you know, even a super pro will have fun on these relatively easy trails. And that was kind of the concept behind flow country trails. That's basically a term I invented for a trail that's never steep, never extreme, and never dangerous. And the guys there in Livigno at Carosello 3000, they built now over 25 miles of these kind of flow country trails. And since they're a ski resort, there is lift access, so you don't have to necessarily pedal up the hill. And what we did last year, we created this bucket list ride, basically combining all the trails on that mountain into a one-day epic, which is called the Tutti Frutti Epic. And it's basically 45 kilometers of flowy single trails, some natural trails as well, and 11,000 feet of vertical. And you basically just get a bike pass, you know, a lift ticket. And a good rider can do it in 4 hours, you know. Or, you know, most people take a little more time because there's so many cool little restaurants and huts along the way where you can stop and have lunch or have a cappuccino or homemade sausages or whatever you feel like eating.
I think the ride sounds like such a cool thing. You call it a bucket list ride. People should put it on their bucket list and give it a shot. When is it?
Well, it's a permanent route that anybody can go and ride. You know, they can either do it themselves. We just established the ride. There will be maps available or signs even how to, you know, which trail to go next to. They have a lot of information on their website, and last year, Brian Lopes and myself went there to establish this route, and we made a film with it, which can be seen now on YouTube or on the web, you know, on their website. And it gives you a really good idea about the ride. And the idea is people can now go and do it at their own pace, at their own, you know. And of course, I'll be there, and I'm going to do this loop a few times this summer. You know, I'm not there all summer long, but on and off, I'm going to stop by there. And the neat thing is, you know, it's there. And the only thing is this year they have, they're building a brand, one of the lifts they're changing, and they're building a brand new gondola on. And so you might not be able to ride the loop 100% as we did in the film, but you can still do it, and you can still basically have a lot of fun and have endless flow.
Well, what's interesting, so I didn't understand that this is a permanent ride. So you'll be able to pick up a map when you get there and then follow that route, and it's the Tutti Frutti tour of the facility, not just a one-day event.
Right, you know, it's a big, like the whole enchilada, you know, that famous ride in Moab where they combine the Porcupine and the Slick Rock and all those trails into one big loop. And it's a bit like this, you know, so basically it's all their best trails combined into a one-day epic tour. And it gives you, you know, there's like signs and stuff, so you kind of know which trail to take next or which lift to take up next after you've done, you know, just the downhills.
Well, I thought one of the interesting things when I read over all of the literature and information that you sent me was that you got to take these lifts up and you didn't have to pedal up, that you could just coast down and have, or ride, you know, pedal down. And a lot of downhills, a lot of fun, sort of, as you would say, flowy downhills.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's the great thing about these places where you have the lift service. You know, sometimes you just want to go out and have fun. And trust me, if you do this 45-kilometer ride, you still get a workout, even though you go 99% downhill. And there's some flat spots. There's maybe 200 or 300 feet of climbing in it. So it's really not much compared to the 11,500 feet of downhill. Really cool, you know.
You think?
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you have to take your own bike? Will they have bike rental there?
Oh, they have everything. Livigno is, they hosted the Mountain Bike World Championships in 2005. And even before that, they started getting into mountain biking. They have, in this town, they have 12 bike-specific hotels. I mean, there's dozens of hotels, but they have these bike-specific hotels. They have bike shops, rentals, guide services. They have everything. And even, you know, and they have pump tracks in different places in town, and they have incredible road bike riding. You know, it's like right there on the border of eastern Switzerland. So they have, it's this really beautiful panoramic valley, and a lot of road cyclists go there actually to do altitude training, because all these famous road passes like the Stelvio and Gavia passes, they are all there. So all summer long you see these pro teams training there, and then you have also a lot of traffic from these Transalp riders. You know, in Europe, it's very popular to do a Transalp trip, which is usually when you ride your bike for 6 days across the Alps, you know, usually from north to south, and you stop in different towns along the way where you sleep, and the next day you continue. And Livigno is one of those towns where a lot of these Transalp routes come through, so they get a lot of these Transalp riders. So it's really a bit a slice of heaven for any kind of cyclist.
Wow, it sounds like everybody who knows anything about riding would want to be there at some time this summer. So do you have a schedule of when you will be there personally?
I'm going to be there next week for a day, and then I'm going to be back in the middle of June, right before the Crankworx Festival in Innsbruck. Then I'm going to go back again in around July 6th. For like 5 or 6 days. And then I'm going to go later in the summer, probably right before and after Eurobike show at the end of August. So.
Okay. Well, I'm just thinking if somebody wants to meet the famous Hans Rey, it would be really fun to meet you in Italy as opposed to at, you know, either Interbike or Eurobike or any of the other shows. Out on the road is much more exciting, I think, than cooped up in a convention hall.
Yeah, it would be fun to do a few laps there on the mountain with some people.
How can people find out about this Tutti Frutti tour of this park? Where is the information posted?
Well, you can go to the Carlos Bello 3000 website, or you can go onto my YouTube channel and find the film there. There's a 17-minute film that really gives you a taste of what to expect, you know.
I watched the film yesterday. One of the coolest things I saw was those lifts, how they kind of come up out of the ground. And, you kind of pop up onto the surface, and then you can ride down. I really like those.
Yeah, they have some very modern ski lifts in Europe. It's amazing what they built there and the service they, provide for their skiers or bikers. It's sometimes ages ahead of some of the outdated lifts we ride here in North America sometimes.
I think it's the same with a lot of things. It seems for as old as Europe is, it's very modern in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Well, Hans, thank you so much for talking with me today. We will post the information about the Tutti Frutti Tour and about Carosello 3000. And I hope you have a fun trip over and a great summer.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Diane. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hans Rey joined me from his home in California as he's readying himself to get over to Carosello 3000 to ride that great 45-kilometer course. He has invited us all to come ride with him. I would love to go do that. You can probably check his schedule out on his YouTube channel, as he suggested, if you are interested. That's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Kaylee Fretz, Peter Cosens, Jenna McLaughlin, and of course Hans for being my guests this week. Once again, if you are interested, you can go to the GoFundMe.com/WhiteyPrincesses and help support the five girls whose wonderful father passed away this week. Thanks for listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Hope to see you right back here next week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.